This oral history interview is being conducted by the Area 53 Archives Committee to pass on the history of our fellowship through the shared experience and memories of our members. No duplication or reuse of this interview beyond sharing on platforms of the Area 53 Archives Committee is authorized without the express written consent of both the member being interviewed and the Area 53 Archives Committee. Today we are interviewing June B. from Columbus, Ohio. Her date of sobriety is May 7th, 1970, and her home group, she tells me, is whatever group she happens to be going to at the moment. June, for starters, I'd like to hear a little bit about your life before you came to AA. Could you please tell me a little bit about what was going on before you came to AA? Maybe where you were born, a little bit about your childhood.
I was born in Columbus, Ohio, at Grant Hospital. And my mother was a black belt Christian, and my dad was a periodic alcoholic. And I was a spoiled little girl, and I was daddy's girl. And I loved my siblings. We were a very close family. My sister, I have three sisters and a brother, and we were very close. And I always had a best friend, but I didn't hang around with a lot of people because I really enjoyed doing things with my sisters, especially. They were each about 16, 18 months older than I, two of my sisters. So that was, I had a happy childhood. I was very happy, very spoiled. I got the first new bicycle, the only new bicycle in the family, the only new tricycle in the family. It was like that. I was just a spoiled kid.
Sounds like being daddy's girl has its benefits. Now, I think you told me before we began the interview that you primarily lived in Butler while you were a young girl?
No. Pardon. I lived in Columbus until I was 9. And then we bought a farm outside Belleville. And we lived there for about 4 years. And then we moved to Butler, and that's where I finished school in Butler.
I see.
And that's where I married when I lived in Butler. And after I married, we moved to Mansfield, which was primarily my home base from then until 1985 when I moved permanently to Columbus. But that was a home base. It wasn't certainly where I lived all those years, but that's where I went home to. That's where my parents lived and my siblings and my children.
When you became an adult, what did you do for a living?
I started as working behind a little counter in I think Isley Dairy Store or something like that in Mansfield as a little waitress. And then when I started drinking, I was a barmaid and a waitress. And I learned to do display advertising. And so I did those kind of things. My favorite jobs I had as an adult were working in display advertising, which I did both when I was drinking and when I was sober. And after I was sober, I was an alcoholism counselor. And I was one of the first 100 alcoholism counselors credentialed in the state of Ohio. At first, it was just a peer credential. And then it became state credential and all the other things after. So every 2 years, we had to re-up. So those were the kind of things I did. And I need to say that when I became an alcoholism counselor, AA crucified me.
Ah.
It was not a popular thing back then when it was a brand new profession. They said, you're selling what we gave you free. And they didn't like it at all that I was an alcoholism counselor. But anyway, I really enjoyed that, and I always enjoyed being working in display advertising. Those are my favorite things I did. And I was a house mother in for a women's halfway house in Ashland, Kentucky for a very brief period. I don't think I will talk much about that, but it was very brief, and I didn't know what I was doing. They came to Columbus and hired me, and they came looking for someone to help them open a women's halfway house, and they took them, and I... Somebody said, go hire June, so they did, and I went down there for a brief thing. But okay, other than that, I pretty much enjoyed all the things I had to do in being a counselor.
You said you were married and you had some children?
Yes, I have 4 sons, 2 of whom are dead and 2 of whom are alive. 2 have passed already.
And how did you start drinking, Jim?
How did I what, honey?
Start drinking?
Oh, I was trying to be a black belt Christian like my mom and be a good Christian mother, and I was married to an alcoholic like my father. And they say repeat or recover. I was repeating. And my sister and her husband were going to come out and play cards with me and my husband one night. And they brought along some friend of theirs, a guy friend of theirs. And my husband didn't come home. He was out drinking, because that's what alcoholics do. So we played cards, and this guy I'd never seen before was my partner. And my husband wandered in sometime during that, drunk, turned around and walked back out. And then, of course, that kind of put a damper on the evening, so they left. And he came home more drunk than he was and beat me up and threw me out of the house for being an unfit mother and having an affair with this person I didn't know, had never seen before. So I took a cab to my sister's house, and she threw me out, and I didn't drive. And I asked her for a beer. And I was a fundamental Christian woman that didn't drink or swear or any of that kind of stuff. So asking for a beer was unusual. And when I drank that beer, I felt okay. I felt okay. It was like that movie, Waiting to Exhale. And I stayed away from my family. I ran like the wind once I got out of that house. I had 3 sons then. I left them with my husband, and I drank. And that's how I started drinking. I found the bars, and I went home maybe once or twice, and I had to go. They made me go back home for a minute or two, and it was just unbearable.
If I may, how old were you when that episode occurred?
23.
I see. That's pretty young to suffer that kind of circumstances. And then when and how did your drinking get out of control? It sounds like you're describing that it took off pretty quick.
Immediately. And you know what I know now about it is that for all I was trying to be this good Christian mother, I was starting to cut corners. I would steal a cigarette out of my husband. This sounds funny, but I would steal a cigarette or two out of my husband's pack. And when the kids were down for a nap, I would smoke that cigarette. So I was already starting to cut corners. And what I know now was spiritual erosion was setting in for me. I learned that word in recovery, those words, spiritual erosion. I was starting to cut the corners, you know. I'm going to smoke and nobody will know about it. Well, good deal. And then I wouldn't go to church maybe on Wednesday night because I had too much to do that day. And I went, you know, I just started cutting corners, and I didn't realize it till I was sober a really long time and realized that that's what was happening, spiritual erosion. Because I was a good woman. I was a good mother and a good wife and a good everything on the outside. But my insides were already rolling along, so that as soon as I added alcohol, I was gone. You know, I mean, I ran like the wind with that. And they were going to, my family didn't have any idea what happened. And they were going to probate me because they said I must be crazy because I adored the people I love most in the world are my 3 sons. That was all my world was, as far as I knew. I didn't neighbor. I didn't have friends. I had family and my kids. And then there I was out drinking in the bars and staying in a hotel and doing all kind of things against my value system.
And if I'm doing my math right, that was right around 1958, 1960, right in through there, right?
Probably, yeah.
How did you know when you had hit bottom? When obviously things were going pretty hard and fast for a while.
The first time I really hit bottom was in New York City with one of my sweethearts, and I knew I wanted to go back home with my kids. I couldn't stand it anymore. I couldn't stand drinking. The glamour of New York City was not enough. Nothing was enough. I wanted my sons. And I called my ex-husband, who had been trying to get me to come home the whole time, but he had found it like 2.5 days later. He had a girlfriend or something, and he was already, they were serious and planning on getting married as soon as they. And I called him and said, I want to come home. because he had been trying everything he could to get me to come home. And he said, you'll have to call me back. I have to talk to Mary. So I called back, and Mary got on the phone and said, you'll never hurt this family again like you did. I will take you to court and prove you an unfit mother. And so I hung up, and I was in New York City in a little dinky residential apartment, the broom thing. And for some reason, I had sleeping pills, which I wasn't a drug addict. I was a drunk. But anyway, I didn't want to live anymore. And so my sweetheart went on and went to bed, and I got up my sleeping pills and decided that I would just commit suicide. I didn't want to live without my sons. So I got a glass of water and started to pop my pills, and I took a couple of them, and he decided to get up and come out and see what I was doing. And I was taking my pills, and I always lived with such sweet charmers. So he just took my pills and slapped me silly and threw them down the trash down the sink, and washed them away and went back to bed. So obviously I didn't die, but that was my bottom. And after that, I decided anybody was going to hurt, it wasn't going to be me no more. I wasn't going to hurt anymore like that. And so I just went flashing on through my drinking career.
So that was a kind of an early bottom, but yeah. You kept drinking for a while.
Right. I had, and I would I'd drink daily for a long time, and then I'd clean up my act. And then I'd drink daily, and then I'd clean up my act. And usually when I got married a lot. And I'd get married, and I was going to settle down and be a good Christian mother again. I had another son after I got out in the streets. So he was always with me through my whole drinking career. And there were several times. Actually, when I was drinking about a year, I got real sick one night with the flu or something. And I didn't have anywhere to go. And I went to my mom and dad's. And, of course, they always took me in. And when I got up the next day, I thought, maybe I'm an alcoholic. Maybe I'm just an alcoholic. And I'm going to go to AA and see what that's. So I found the club room in Mansfield, Ohio, and I went there in the afternoon, and some woman talked to me, and she said, I know it was on Tuesday, because she said, we have a meeting tonight at the church. And I thought, well, I've done church. I'm still drinking. So I thought she was sending me to a church meeting, go to church tonight. And always thinking about the fundamental thing, I said, I can't go to church because I smoke. Never mind, drink a little. Anyway, so then she said, well, there's a meeting tonight, so whatever time. And then she had to go somewhere. And then this guy who was new in recovery came up and talked to me. And he said, listen, if you don't go to the meeting tonight, I'll meet you at the Long Barn. I'll buy you a drink. So I thought, well, that sounded like a better idea than going to church. So I went to the Long Bar, and he didn't show up to buy me a drink. So that was probably my first bottom after I started drinking. And I decided, whatever they do at AA, they tell you to go to church or they'll buy you a drink. I can do that on my own. I don't have to go to there. So I never went to a meeting. I just went up to see what they were about. And I can't, I can't really say a specific, but I didn't come to AA because I thought I hit my bottom. I came to AA because the doctor sent me here.
Okay, and yeah, that was going to be my next question is, when did you first hear about AA and from what source? But it sounds to me like you had heard about AA before, but it was when the doctor referred you that you actually tried in earnest?
No, at first I just searched it out. I just knew the word. The first time when I was sober about a year. So I drank 10 more years, and then the doctor sent me. Well, I came to AA in 1970, the doctor sent me here. But it wasn't because I had thought I'd hit bottom. Well, maybe it was. I said, when I went to that doctor, I was really, really sick, and I thought maybe I'm going to die from drinking. And I thought if I die from drinking, it will be permanent shame to my kids, and I didn't want to bring any more shame to my sons or my family. And I thought they will have to hear all the rest of their life, your mother died drunk. Your mother died drunk. She was just a drunk, And I didn't want that to be my heritage, so I guess that would be a bottom, probably. Sounds bottomish to me.
Agreed. And so it sounds like 1970 is when you went to your first meeting. What did you think of it?
Well, I worn after five dress and went in there with heels and hose and went walking in, walking tall and talking trash. But I had been, my doctor actually sent me, not directly to an AA meeting. My doctor said only an Alkie would do this. My doctor sent me to a garage to get well. He couldn't think of a woman's name in AA, but he wanted me to go to AA. But he knew this guy down the street that had a garage. So when I left there, I was supposed to go down the street to that garage guy, and he called him. And the garage guy took me to my first sponsor's house. And she was my first AA contact. Well, he was the garage guy. Bill was his name. And he took me to Donna, who was my first sponsor, and she told me she was my sponsor, so I didn't know anything about AA. And she talked to me about being powerless over alcohol, which I had just come off a church run of 9 months and hadn't drank for 9 months. So I drank the night before and was going to do a little social drinking to celebrate how good I had become again. And I remember that night the barmaid told me I'd had 17 Brandy's Alexander since she'd been on duty and she ran out of cream. So she was suggesting coffee, and I was suggesting B&Bs for the rest of the night. So obviously I was very, very sick physically. I hadn't had anything to drink for 9 months, and I didn't have a good physical tolerance at the end of my drinking. So I went to that doctor, and the doctor sent me to Bill. Bill took me to Donna. Donna told me to go to a meeting tonight at the club, which is where I went at 1 year when I was so sick. And so I knew where the club was, and I went up to the club, and I dressed nice, wore my nice after five dress, had a great bouffant hairdo, chandelier earrings, heels and hose, and I walked in there walking tall and talking trash, and I felt so sorry for those people sitting around their little Chucky shirts and jeans, and they had these things on the wall that said, let go and let God, one day at a time, easy does it. And I thought, well, I'll have to be careful how I talk to these people because evidently they only can talk in little short sentences. So I was going to try to be very patient with the people in AA.
What can you tell me about your early sobriety? Experience with the steps or working with Donna?
Donna took me through the steps, and I argued with all the steps and did them. Up to about the amends step, kind of, by then. I'm sure she took me through all of those, but I know I didn't do, like, 10, 11, and 12 weren't big things. Probably no amends, actually, at that point in time, except saying I'm sorry to the family. I didn't like AA. I didn't like the people in AA. I didn't consider myself an AA member, really. That's what I did on Thursday night. I went to one meeting a week, and it was a discussion group, and once in a while I would go to a speaker meeting, and I couldn't hear the pain. I would hear the fun parts, and I think, why do they tell me all those funny stories and tell me I'm not supposed to drink? I just didn't get it, you know? So sometimes, once in a while, I go to that, but my regular one was a Thursday night discussion group, and I would go, that's what I did, and I was just going to figure out what AA was about and go on down the road. I wasn't planning on sticking around. I didn't like women. I didn't trust women. If I wanted to talk to women, I talked to my sisters. I was always close with my sisters. And they were kind of clannish. I felt like they were clannish. I felt not included with the old-timers and stuff, which I really wasn't to be trusted around men. I missed picking up men in the bars and doing all that kind of bar kind of mentality stuff. And I was supposed to sit in Mansfield. You had to go, when the meeting came, the women sat with the women and the men sat with the men, auditorium style. And I wouldn't do that. I would go sit over on the men's side because I like men a lot better than I did women. So I wasn't going to be hanging around with those women who were big old losers and just had no interest. I didn't make friends. And I did eventually make friends, but I wasn't interested in doing things with them socially. I wasn't interested in the old timers. All I wanted to do was find out what you do in AA. I would come here on Thursday night and I would do my steps with this lady who I couldn't stand, my first sponsor. I couldn't stand her. And I thought she was ignorant. And sometimes I did what she told me to do just to prove her wrong, which worked out well for me. But I was like, so I didn't have a community. I didn't have an AA community that I felt I belonged to. I had a guy that I liked that we talked to, not a boyfriend guy, but a guy. And I would tell him what I read out of my self-help books on Thursday night. And he would tell me what he read out of the Bible on Thursday night. After the meeting, we would sit around and talk about the Bible and self-help books.
Can I ask you for a moment, did Donna try to work you through the steps out of the big book? Or heard people talk about early AA not necessarily using the big book as much as it gets attention today.
No, she would tell me the steps on the wall, you know, the blind on the wall that they have.
Yes.
I didn't have a big book of my own until I was sober 5 years. They told me, I asked what this big book was they were talking about, and they said I could borrow one, take it home and read it, and then bring it back to the club. So that's what I did, and I thought it was poorly written. I liked the stories in the back. Some of them were funny. And I read it and took it back and thought, not a very well-written book. My thing, and gave it back to him. And
so it sounds to me like that would have been a second edition big book, since that was before 1974 or 5 when the third edition came out.
I don't know what it was. It was nothing I was interested in. And actually, when I moved to Phoenix, I turned 5 years sober in Phoenix. And when they asked me how long I was sober, I said, I don't know. It wasn't an issue. It wasn't a big deal. It's what I did. By then, I was probably going to maybe a couple meetings a week. And when I got sober, they had, I think, 2 or 3 speaker meetings and 1 discussion group at the club. And then they had 1 at the church at 3rd and Bowman. And that meeting is still going at 3rd and Bowman. But those 2 groups didn't like each other. So if you went to 3rd and Bowman, you didn't hang out at the club. And if you went to the club, you didn't go to 3rd and Bowman meeting, except on New Year's Eve, when everybody would get together and have a party at the club.
Do you recall what the differences were? Why they factionalized like that?
Could have been.
Why did they have those 2 separate cliques? Was there a difference of opinion about something, or?
It still is like that. It's a clannish community.
We took a little break, and we're resuming our interview with June B. And while we were off air, she spoke a little bit about having moved out to California, and then when she returned from California, back into Grove City, Ohio. So, June, you want to tell us why was you went to California? And
yes, I did want to tell you why I went to California. When I got sober, my sponsor told me I wasn't allowed to have anything to do with any boyfriends or anything, which was really my major focus besides drinking. And so, of course, I found a boyfriend in AA, and I picked him because I knew him from the bars, and he'd gotten shot and hadn't died. So I thought he was probably a pretty sturdy little fella for a boyfriend, but I got scolded for that, and that was a short-term thing. So I had a sweetheart in California that we continued to correspond and stay in touch, and so I went to California and married him so I could have AA-sanctioned sex.
Okay.
That's why I went back to California. That didn't last very long, but that's why I went back that time.
Okay.
And then I came back here. And then I went to Phoenix, Arizona, and that's where I moved to Grove City. I turned 5 years sober in Phoenix, Arizona. And then when I left there, I came to Grove City and started my Columbus area recovery. Portion of my recovery was in about 75.
And did your AA experience change much when you came to Columbus?
Yes.
How so?
When I was 5 years sober in Phoenix, Arizona, I finally did my surrender. Up to that time, I had surrendered my drinking and my son's discipline, and that was about it. But I finally did a complete surrender in Phoenix. So when I came to Columbus, I was finally teachable. And it was a whole different... Mansfield was very clannish, very judgmental. They told me when I got sober in Mansfield, you're not a bad person that has to get good. You're a sick person and you can get well. And then the next person said, you're lucky you got here before you were before you were a hard-faced whore, indicating that I was a whore. I was just not a hard-faced one. So when I got to Columbus, I was more teachable. I had a wider range from that concept in Mansfield of that you are not a hard-faced whore, but here you are, we'll do what we can, to Phoenix, Arizona, where everybody was freewheeling in their AA recovery, to Columbus, Ohio, which was kind of a good mix. You know, there was not nearly as much judgment and not nearly as much freewheeling. So I became teachable about that point in time.
Did you get a home group here in Columbus?
Oh, yes, I've had dozens of home groups.
Okay.
I do change home groups like I used to change husbands. Just get tired of one, go get another one. Come easy, go easy.
Did any of them stand out as particularly positive experiences for you?
That's a good question. I really like home group, but here's my problem with home group, is I get, I start being feeling like a bleeding deacon. It doesn't matter if I'm sober 5 years, 10 years, or 50 years. I'm there and I love everybody and I like what's going on. And then pretty soon I think, you know, we ought to do this a little different. We ought to do that a little different. And when I'm chairperson, I'm going to do this so that person can get this. I start getting all thinking I know what's going on. And then I leave the group because I know it's not healthy for me or the group. Hmm. So that's one of my main things is that I've enjoyed all my home groups. I think probably I will say Central Office Wednesday noon meeting was a 12 and 12, and I was there for about 4 years. And we just read the 12 and 12 over and over and over. And I think that was probably the best one for me was that.
It's a nice mix of folks there, too,
right,
from all over town.
Right.
What about other groups that might have been especially important to you? Are there certain?
I had to go to Al-Anon. My last husband was younger than I was in recovery, and so, of course, I thought I knew what was going on for him. And he told me, why don't you let me have the experiences that you had, June? And so a friend of his said, why don't you need to go to Al-Anon. So I went to Al-Anon, which I hated. But eventually, I learned the Al-Anon program. I did the Al-Anon steps twice with a sponsor. And what I did with that was I started a double winners group in Columbus and one in Mansfield where it was alcoholics and Al-Anon. And we would take the Al-Anon step book and read a step. And in that book, they have a question. And like at the end of step one, they have maybe 15 questions or something. So when we would meet once a week, we would read those questions and go around. They were small groups, 6-8 people, you know. And I had an Al-Anon sponsor who didn't go to that group, but she was my sponsor, so I did my fourth and fifth steps with her and stuff. So Al-Anon was a big help. I did some adult children of alcoholic work, which was new at that point in time. I was sober about 10 or 12 years or something like that. And I learned some really neat things there. One of the things was, as a child of an alcoholic, I learned, I love you, stay away. I learned that's what I learned, and so I'm sure I pass that on to my children as an active alcoholic. And I learned the important things, don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. that's what I learned as a child of an alcoholic. Don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. And I think those are, well, prove to me you love me. Prove to me you love me. Those were the three significant things I did. I think Claudia Black was the new, it was the pioneer things. And I learned some really good things about me that I was sober 10 or 12 years, but I didn't know those pieces to deal with even.
So it helped you look at your
absolutely
character defects in your own inventory within the AA 12 steps as well, it sounds like. Helped to inform that experience.
Right.
Let's go on a little bit have you ever started any groups or been involved in starting any AA groups? You mentioned the Double Winners group. Where is that located?
It's in Mansfield, but it's turned into an Al-Anon group now. But it was That turned out to be a really large group. We would have 20, 25 people. I mean, for that kind of group, it grew to 20, 25 people, and it was a good mix of AA and Al-Anon, and then now they say that it's just Al-Anon, but it's still going on. And the other one was one that I just had in my home, and so it was a fun group. But no, I haven't done anything about starting new groups. I'm not stable enough to do that. I would wander off from.
You told me while we were taking a break that while you didn't develop many close, influential AA relationships in Mansfield, that in Central Ohio you developed some good AA friends that have been important in your sobriety. Could you share a little bit about some of those folks?
Well, let's see. I ran with Charlie for a long time just as a buddy. And I learned a lot from him. He was so easygoing, and he went all the time. He would go to Talbot Hall and pass out his marbles to the new people there and tell them, you know, here, he'd give them a little card, and they'd give him two marbles, and it said, if you think about drinking, throw away one of your marbles, and if you pick up a drink, then throw away the other one because you've lost all your marbles. And so he was real good helping me learn how to talk to new people, to the newcomer. He helped me a great deal with that, Charlie did. My Al-Anon sponsor I found in Columbus, she was wonderful. I met her, we both worked at Talbot Hall at the same time, and I met her there. But she wasn't my sponsor then, but she became one later. Some of the people at Central, trying to think of some specific people. I think just, I never was in a situation where there was cross cultures like there are in Columbus. And so being with cross cultured people of other color, another heritage, another, all those, you know, Native American, African American, Chinese and Asian people, and all different walks of life from my standard stuff I was used to. I think that mix has been the best for me because it's opened my mind and my heart to all those things. And the inner city meetings I love. I just love the simplicity, the population variation, those kind of things have been real important to me.
And it sounds like working with Charlie was a great introduction to 12 step work for you. Right. And how about sponsorship? Did you get a sponsor when you came to Columbus?
Oh yeah, I've had lots of sponsors, just like home groups. Come and go.
Okay.
I've had great sponsors, and three of my sponsors have been men, actually. But I made sure they were men that I wasn't going to fall in love with or confuse. Then that's what they told me early on, is the reason we do gender specific is so that we don't confuse the person, the sponsor, with the program. Because if you're a woman and you have a man sponsor and he takes off and you fall in love with him, then he takes off and you think the program didn't work. So I made sure they were people that I wouldn't want to be intimate with or have that kind of a relationship with. But I had some really good male sponsors.
Could you share a little bit about your experience sponsoring other people?
Okay. You know, the first person I sponsored that fired me, I cried and cried and cried, and I thought it was because I was a terrible sponsor. And now today I know that I was just a step on the path. I know that about myself. That's what I consider myself as a sponsor, is that I'm a step on the path toward the sunlight of the Spirit. And if they stay on that step for a long time, God bless them. If they stay there a little while and want to step on another stepping stone, God bless them. But it took me a long time to learn that. When I was in Mansfield, I knew at sponsoring, and I tried to sponsor this woman who was on psychiatric medication. And I didn't know anything about what I was doing. And they always said you couldn't take any drugs when you're sober. So I told her she had to quit taking her drugs. And at a meeting one day, she said, I really feel awful. You need to take me to the mental health center. So I took her to there, and I waited, and I waited, and I said, finally asked one of the staff, I said, when is so-and-so going to be finished? They said, oh, she's not going home with you today. You need to go. You can go ahead and go. So I went out to my car, and they were taking her out in a straitjacket, putting her in a thing. So I learned about that I was not a doctor. I could not tell people what medications to take. So I've had some really awkward experiences. I've had some great experiences. I have a little girl that I sponsor that lives in California. She's been out there 3 years, and she still calls me every week and calls me her sponsor. I have a friend in Mexico that I used to sponsor in Columbus, and she calls me about every couple weeks. And I have a friend in Alaska who calls me her Columbus sponsor. So when she's in Columbus, her family, I met her in Columbus, and her family here. So she comes, doesn't come often, but we talk periodically. And at this point in time, I don't sponsor new women because I'm too impatient and I wouldn't be a good sponsor. But I still sponsor some people that I've been sponsoring. But not a lot. I'm not one that gets that ego trips on somebody else's expense. That I got all these 99 people I sponsor. I don't think that's right.
June, we've been friends for a while, and you've been through some pretty tough times as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Could you share about some of the tough times that and how you've gotten through those with the use of the AA program, maybe times even when you've been tempted to drink?
Well, I've had two unsuccessful marriages since I've been sober. And I think getting a divorce is like having a baby. It always hurts no matter how many times you've done it. So those were hard times to go through. Two of my sons have passed. That's definitely a hard time to go through. There aren't really words to describe what that's like. But you know, I experienced my first family death, which was my dad, who I was so close to, and then I lost two sibs, both my parents and two of my sons. And the good news is, my AA friends walked beside me, but they let me feel my grief, and they let me deal with my grief however I needed to deal with it. And they didn't try to fix me, they were just always there to walk beside me and not try to make me feel good or take away the pain. I mean, they were just there like the feel, deal, and heal, you know? So I'm really grateful for that. Let's say I've been bankrupt, and that was a shameful experience for me. And I felt a lot of shame about that. I've been had all the money and stuff I wanted also since I've been sober. So that was a nice time. I was supposed to be talking about things. It's like sometimes I can hardball and then I just do what I know, what you taught me. And I don't burn today. I turn my life over. On the other side of it, I try to see what I learn. I don't believe there's any waste in God. I do not believe he wastes anything. The shame I felt of being a non-custodial parent when I came to AA was overwhelming. And it was out there, kept me drinking. But I can't tell you how many women I have talked about being a non-custodial parent, what that felt like when I've given my talk, you know, I'd come up and say, nobody's ever talked about me. I was that. Thank you. So I just believe that my deepest pain and shame, that my higher power has used that. He doesn't, there's no waste in it. And my most painful experience is touch somebody else's life and get well.
Yeah. Your experience in the hands of God. We talked earlier a little bit about the big book. Did you find the big book more useful after some time in sobriety?
Yes. I've read the big book and I came to understand and love it. I understand that it's, to me, it's a guideline. It's like a, I think they call it, I used to call it the North Star. They tell me it's like the North Star. It's a guide, you know. I might want to go from here to Mansfield, and it would say take Route 71, but I might want to take Route 42, but I still will get to Mansfield. But I need to know that if I get on Route 71, that's a recommended route to go from Columbus to Mansfield. I might want to take 23 and go through some other towns and still get to Mansfield. So for me, the big book is like a North Star. I still use that even though it's obsolete.
But, and Bill had the humility to put that statement in there that our book is meant to be suggestive only. We only know a little.
I also want to say one thing about when I got sober, they were still using the absolutes. Honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And when I saw that purity on the wall, they had these great big things on the wall. I said, honestly, you know, very big. Each one had a word on it. So when I saw purity, I thought, man, I'm dead in the water on that one. And my sponsor said, that's purity of intention. So I learned that. And that was one of the things that I actually did learn early on was that. And it talks about that in some of the AA literature, is that when they use the absolutes, that they would, when you were first sober, if you needed to make a decision, that's what you did. Is it honest? Is it loving? Honesty, purity, unselfish, and are your intentions right? So that was actually something I learned, that they would hold it up to that. And then if they couldn't get a satisfactory answer, then they would go to their sponsor. But they used the absolutes first.
In your earlier time in sobriety, there's always some challenges for AA groups in dealing with certain circumstances. How did the groups, or what was your experience with how groups were dealing with the people who were frequently relapsing, or people who had issues other than alcohol, or people who were 13th stepping? What kind of experiences around those types of issues?
Well, they were pretty open to a relapse or coming back a few times, but as they did it chronically, there was a guy in Mansfield that said nobody went 13th or went 12 stepping anymore. But they all had 12 stepping and he continued to drink, you know. So when nobody went 12 stepping anymore, he got sober. So they figured out that was sad. 13th stepping, I can't really comment on that because I did a little of that myself a couple of times. So, and I was judged for it personally. And chronic relapses and alcohol problems other than alcohol, it's a lot more accepting today than it was then. In 1970, you just didn't talk about that stuff. It was not anything you talked about. That's when you talked to your doctor about it, but it wasn't ever, if you started talking about it, they'd say, this is an AA meeting, we're talking about alcohol, you know.
These days, there's a fairly, treatment centers are fairly well known, and you talked about how you went to work early in the development of that industry. Were the treatment centers that you were familiar with working at Talbot or elsewhere, were they using a 12-step based program, or what was their approach?
And would you repeat that question?
In working in the treatment centers whether you were going in with Charlie or working as a professional, were the programs usually 12-step based or?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. They were all 12-step based.
Pretty much trying to steer people into AA after they got them detoxed and gave them some education?
When Talbot was first open, Charlie and I used to go there. They had a coffee room, and AA people went in there. We went in there, and we drank coffee with the clients. The clients would come in there. We'd go in and drink coffee and just hang out with them and socialize like that. So,
a little opportunity for sharing your experience.
Absolutely.
That's beautiful.
And, I never worked anywhere that wasn't AA-based.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about your service experience. I know that you've done some volunteer work down at our central office, the intergroup office, COGF. Did you do any service work in the area as well, or primarily focused on the intergroup?
I actually was a paid employee at central office. I wasn't a volunteer.
Okay, yeah, wonderful.
Did I do any other service work? Yeah, some guys came and told me they wanted me to be the director of treatment center facility one time. I didn't know anything about that stuff. So when I got sober in Mansfield, I need to say this. The traditions were on the wall. And when I asked them what the traditions were, they said, oh, that's just some of Bill Wilson's crap. Don't worry about it. So I didn't know all that stuff. That was their attitude about it back then, you know. And
yeah,
people came in from Cleveland to talk to them about it. They ran them out of the room and said, get out of here. We're doing what we want.
Yeah, there was a lot of resistance when Bill introduced the traditions.
Yeah. So, the other question. Oh, yeah. So I tried to be the director of that for the treatment facilities thing, and that lasted about 2 months. And I realized that I was not good at being a director. I wanted to be the boss. I would give people, say, will you take care of this? Will you take care of that? And then we'll get together. And if I didn't agree with their stuff, I would just be bossy.
And by director, I believe you mean like the chairperson of the Area Treatment Facilities Committee?
Yeah, that was it. And I told him, I said, I don't want to do this because I can't allocate things the way they're supposed to be allocated. I take things personally, and I don't want to be I don't want that job anymore. And they said, oh, we'll teach you how to do it. They were kind of patronizing about it. And I said, I don't want to learn how to do it. I don't want the job. You have to give it to somebody else. So I quit after a month or two because I know that I've come as I get older and watch my patterns is that I'm not really good at allocating, not really good at being just
delegating to others.
I immediately, just like I told you about home groups, I start wanting to smooth on in there and take over. And so far that hasn't been lifted from me. It can be periodically, but not in the long run. I continue to fall into that pattern. And I know it's not good for me or AA, so I don't do it.
So most of your AA service has been pretty much at the individual level of working with sponsees? And
I stand near the door.
Right.
That's my service work. I stand near the door.
And it sounds like you carry a powerful message to these ladies that there's hope.
I try to carry a good message. I think God gave me a message to carry, and I try to carry it responsibly.
Could you share with me, Gina, were there any, like, conventions, conferences, those types of things that you enjoyed, like the general service conferences that used to be held here or the spring roundup and those types of things? Did you ever attend those?
I used to love spring roundup, yes, and Founders Day. I loved Founders Day. I was out in Phoenix 5 years sober, and they were asking me about Founders Day. You must just live close to Founders Day. Tell us about that. I'd never even been there. So I did. I went to Founders Day. I enjoyed that. But I don't go now because as I get older, I'm more claustrophobic and there's too many people there. But I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed experiencing the early AA things. I loved the spring roundup especially. I didn't miss any of those, I don't think, from Jump Street. I just always liked it. I was a speaker at one of them, and I was on a panel at one of them. So that gave me a different kind of experience with it, you know, to be a participant.
I remember that. I believe that was an old-timers panel.
Yeah.
And that was a while ago.
Yeah. At one of them, one of the last few ones they had. I was a speaker. The first one of the evening, you know, or on Friday night. Yeah, I was that speaker one.
The early bird speaker.
Yeah, and I really liked that, and I saw people there every year that I didn't see any other time except at Spring Roundup, so I kind of missed that one.
Was there anything accomplished along the way in your service experience that you feel particularly good about, you know, having been a part of? Yeah. Obviously, you've been involved in the lives of a lot of women over these years.
I don't have anything that stands out. I just think the thing that stands out to me is that I try to learn to be consistent, to carry a message in, and to learn new things. I belong to a meeting called World Hello, and I get and people from all over the world write into that. That's a meeting by mail, which is registered with New York City. And people from all over the world write on a topic, you know, and so I learn. That's where I got the term spiritual erosion from that and those kind of things. And I will say maybe that, because it gives me more of a sense of our alcoholism truly is a universal disease. You know, it manifests itself all different ways. But it's the same disease and the same answer. I've been writing to a semi-hermit monk in Slovenia for about 4 or 5 years. And we exchanged letters it takes about 2 weeks to get there and 2 weeks to get back. Well, that was before COVID. But so about once a month, sometimes one of us is a little lazy. He's one that I have had a long-term correspondence with. And that's been real rewarding. And I can say that's a really... I think now somebody told me the other day that New York is putting out a pamphlet on loners and things like that because of COVID. And so I write probably, we get a meeting by mail 4 times a year. And so when I first get mine, it's like a newsletter. And I write my share in, send it to the editor, and everybody else does, and we get that. And then we write to each other, like we would talk to each other between meetings. We write to each other between when the meeting by mail comes. So I probably write to 10 to 15 people each edition in different places, sometimes different countries, sometimes around America, sometimes in, and I don't have many long-term ones that I stay with, because I'm a short-term person. You already figured that out, but except for the priest in Slovenia, and that's not my first religion, so I will say that.
One of the things I would, I know from my own experience with corrections, I'm wondering if this is the same with you. When I write it, it pretty much is sets me up for doing a 10th step, because when I write to somebody, I need to be authentic. Right. Is that your experience too?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So you put it down in pen and ink, you can see on paper. It's easy to talk, you know, talk. But when I put it on, I always try to put what my AA focus is right now. You know, if like right now, the ones I wrote this time, my focus has recently been on empathy rather than sympathy or fixing or pity or adoration or anything. Because that's how Bill and Bob are, just empathy, heart to heart, you know. I know what that feels like. I've been there. I've done that. Or I wonder what that feels like. It feels, sounds, it makes me think it must be. And so I put that in my, each of my, my focus right now in recovery is empathy. So each time I write to somebody, I try to focus on, to see what I really am focusing on in my country, on my recovery, because if I don't have something I can identify, I feel like my program will get kind of sloshy, because it does get sloshy sometimes, and I have to bring it back into focus, you know. So that helps me focus on what am I really looking at right now with myself and my healing, you know.
Get ourselves to hearken back to the solution.
Right? Correct.
You talked a little bit about having been a paid employee at the Intergroup, but I also remember seeing you on the phones at times, I think, where you were a volunteer. Tell me a little bit about your Intergroup office experience and who you were working with down there and so forth.
When I worked there?
Yeah, either there or when you were volunteering on the phones.
I was especially, when I worked there, I was especially fond of making the newsletter, and I know that comes from my years of being in display advertising, that I was familiar with writing copy and making it readable and things like that. And it was a whole different newsletter than it is now. We had 3-4 pages of meeting schedules and speakers, you know, like everybody would call in who was their speaker for the month and who was a chairperson. We'd have 2, 3, 4 pages of that. And it was, they had flyers involved. And when I put them together, we would have this great long conference table, and we'd put all the pages, and people would come, maybe half dozen, 6, 8 people, and we would just march around the table and get all, and it was a fun, full day experience for all of us. It was a great
I remember, and I expect this is part of what you're talking about here, when newcomers would be told if they don't have anything to do, go down to the central office and ask for something to do.
Right. And I liked watching the humanness of interacting with people who are looking for direction on all the time, all day long, people coming in looking for direction. And it taught me a lot about the human reaction to the about empathy. I guess that I won't use that word. It taught me a lot about empathy, but like, this person comes in and wants to know stuff. They're new, or they're new in town, or they're new in recovery. And you don't just give them an answer and send them away. It's not like that. But I learned that by being there all day long and seeing new people come and old people come. And I learned about to love the diversity. I would put that. I love the diversity of central office.
And who were the office managers that you were working with there at that time?
Donna. Okay. Yeah. I was also her sponsor.
I see.
It was a little awkward.
She gave me a lot of hope when I heard Donna talk. She was one of the first people I heard speak. And then I wanted to ask you a little bit about how your AA experience has been going during this COVID pandemic. What are you doing about going to meetings now that so many have been shut down? And
at first, I didn't do anything except just telephone talk for the first 2 or 3 months, which was the longest period I'd gone. I still try to, for years, I've tried to maintain a minimum of 3 meetings a week. Well, obviously, I couldn't do that. But as they open back up, I go to meetings. I don't drive anymore, but I have people who, I have a wonderful support system that takes me to meetings. And I started to go back to meetings, and if I went to a meeting where people were not wearing masks, I didn't go to that meeting anymore. But as I found the ones, little groups where they were wearing masks, then I would try to go to that, and that's still what I do. I go now to at least 2 and usually 3 if I can, meetings a week, because I'm really comfortable with that. But as I watch them transition, some add more masks and some take masks away. So I kind of try to stay flexible with that, and I am a pretty flexible person with my program. So I especially right now like the Thursday 11 o'clock meeting at Central Office, because they are adamant about you will keep your mask on during the whole meeting, except if you're eating or drinking. Other than that, keep your mask on. I go Tuesday at McKinley, and that's a larger meeting, but they are insistent that wear a mask if you're there. And I have a little place I can, at McKinley, I have a corner I get in where people won't, I don't feel like I will be breathed on or, you know, contaminated. And at Central Office, they're very, very strict about that. And then I pick up my third meeting wherever I can. I've been going to Old Coda ever since it opened 39 years ago. It's their 39th anniversary Friday night. And my name was on as one of the first meeting people there. So that's fun. And I have a corner there where I get in and I put a chair in front of me and I sit on my own. I sit on my walker and take my own beverage, and I take Clorox wipes, you know, Lysol wipes, and hand sanitizer, and wear my mask, and go in. And I'm not the jolly. I give people an elbow bump if they want to do something. I really like. I'm really a hugger. I like to hug people, but I don't do that anymore. I just elbow bump them, and I wear long sleeves, so I elbow bump if somebody wants to do some kind of body contact.
This sounds like going to any lengths here when you're talking about, you know, getting yourself out there and setting some reasonable boundaries.
God gave me a message to carry. It's my responsibility, as long as I wake up in the morning and turn my life over, it's my responsibility to be of service however I can. And somebody told me, said, you can't be of service if you're home every day. And I said, yes, you can. Yes, you can. You can text somebody, send a text hug to somebody you know is hurting, or call and ask them how they're doing, or be there when somebody calls from Alaska or Mexico or California, or be there, just be there, you know, and be honest and authentic, to be authentic with them. So I ask every day to be of service, and in the evening I try to see if I have been of service, and so far so good.
We're taking that evening inventory. We've talked earlier, and you don't use Zoom for some of the meetings that are developed there. So that hasn't really shaped your experience, and other members have been using that. But for you, reconnecting with the groups as they've reopened has been your primary way of getting to attend AA meetings.
Correct.
What I understand. Yes. If we could... are you familiar? We know that the pandemic has created, you know, there, unfortunately, it appears that we've lost some members, both due to the virus and perhaps due to a relapse in drinking. How prevalent have those experiences been in your AA circle?
What I have found is that when people who were used have been told from when they first came that you need to go to so many meetings a week, or you need to go to this and this on a regular basis, and then we got the pandemic and they went like 3 or 4 months and didn't do any meetings and they weren't drinking and their life was going along okay, that people are just stepping away from AA like, I'm doing all right without it. You know, I have one girl that told me she was going to quit AA. She's got I think 25 years or something like that. And her husband's got 25 years. They're somewhere in that area. And she said she was looking at some other spiritual avenues. And she said, I don't want to have done well without AA. I don't want to feel guilty because I don't want to be a sponsor anymore. I feel guilty because I'm not going to meetings anymore. I feel guilty. And I don't want to feel guilty all the time. I want to continue to explore spirituality. And I'm going to not do AA anymore. And I said, you have my blessing. We're not a cult. You're allowed to leave anytime you want to leave. But she's one of the first ones that has expressed, I'm getting along fine without it. And I feel guilty if I don't do all the things I've done all these years. And I don't want to feel guilty. I want to feel good. So, and I see other people who don't talk about it, but who are doing the same, like, I haven't been in a meeting for 6 months. My life is just the same as it was when I used to go every week. So I think what I've seen is people stepping away because they don't think they need the program. They don't need the meetings. They may need the program principles, but not the meetings. So that's been what I've seen is people that just stepped away like I did the first 3 or 4 months. I didn't go to a meeting for about 3 months or four or something last year. But as they became available, I just feel my responsibility to carry a message, and so I do.
But it sounds like throughout that time you had access to the newsletter meeting that you talked about, and as well as the writing opportunities to share, telephone, some of those types of things, right. You continue to do to stay in touch.
Absolutely.
And as well as it's evident to me that using the 11th step is a big part of how you live life.
Absolutely.
Before I conclude the interview, June, I'd just like to ask you if there's anything else you would like to share that maybe hasn't been addressed, something that you think is an important part of your experience that you would like to share.
Yeah. I want to tell about the Statue David. When I give my talk, I always end with the Statue David, and so I would like to end our interview with that. It said somebody asked Michelangelo how he carved a Statue David. And he said he took a chunk of marble and he chipped away everything that wasn't David. And that's what's happened to me in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You took a chunk of marble and you chipped away everything that wasn't June. You took the AA tools from the AA toolbox and you started chipping piece by piece by piece. Until the woman I am today is the woman I am today. Because you guys loved me and you... They told me in my first meeting, if I could go 24 hours without taking a drink, I could become the woman that God intended me to be. And that's how I am becoming that woman, because you took the AA tool from the AA toolbox and you chipped away at that woman that walked through the door with that big bouffant hairdo and chandelier earrings and after five dress and high heels and knew what was going on. And you just start chipping away piece by piece by piece. So that's how I would like to end. But thank you, AA, for the patience you've had with me to let me heal at my own pace and not to insist on arbitrary timelines and those kind of things. So that's how I would like to, just talking about the Statue David.
Great analogy.
All right. This concludes the oral history interview with June B. from Columbus, Ohio. I'd like to thank June for her willingness to participate and for your time.
Thank you.
I love you.
Thank you.
Thank you, June.